Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading out of True West Magazine, February-March 2022 edition. Did Doc Kill Ringo? By Bob Bozbell, Gary Roberts, Jeff Morey, Casey Tieferteller, and Tom Bossenecker. Once and for all, historians set the record straight on the tragic demise of the legendary gunfighter. July 2nd, 1882. John Ringo has decided to move to Tombstone. He has been living in San Simon and Galeyville. He arrives in town and meets editor Sam Purdy of the Epitaph, who later writes of their talk. He said that he was as certain of being killed as he was of living then. He said that he might run along for a couple years more and may not last 2 days. Taking in the 4th of July festivities, Ringo drinks heavily, carousing with his many pards. When Ringo rides out of Tombstone several days later, he takes extra bottles of liquor for the road. 2 days later, the King of the Cowboys is spotted at Dial's Ranch in the South Pass of the Dragoons, still drinking. The veritable moving one-man feast, Ringo encounters Deputy Billy Breckinridge, who later writes of the meeting. It was shortly after noon. Ringo was very drunk, reeling in his saddle, and he said he was going to Galeyville. It was in the summer and a very hot day. He offered me a drink out of a bottle of half-full whiskey, and he had another full bottle. I tasted it, and it was too hot to drink. It burned my lips. Knowing that he would have to ride nearly all night before he could reach Galeyville, I tried to get him to go back with me to the Goodrich Ranch and wait until after sundown. But he was drunk and stubborn and went on his way. I think this was the last time he was seen alive. On the afternoon of July 13th, not far from Rustler Park, Ringo's horse gets away from him. He attempts to go after his big bay, but he doesn't get far. A shot is heard at about 3 p.m. at a nearby ranch. John Peters Ringo's body is discovered late in the afternoon on the 14th by a teamster hauling wood. The body is found seated in a bunch of 5 large blackjack oats growing up in a semicircle from one root, and is in the center of them was a large flat rock which made a comfortable seat. The coroner's report. He was dressed in light hat, blue shirt, vest, pants, and drawers. On his feet were a pair of hose, socks, and an undershirt torn up so as to protect his feet. He had evidently traveled but a short distance in this footgear. His revolver he grasped in his right hand, his rifle resting against the tree close to him. He had on 2 cartridge belts, the belt for revolver cartridge being buckled on upside down. The undernoted property was found with him and on his person. 1 Colt's revolver, caliber 45, number 222, containing 5 cartridges. 1 Winchester rifle octagon barrel, caliber 45, model 1876, number 21,986, containing a cartridge in the breech and 10 in the magazine. 1 cartridge belt containing 9 rifle cartridges. 1 cartridge belt containing 2 revolver cartridges. 1 silver watch of American Watch Company, number 9,339, with silver chain attached. $2.60 in money. 6 pistol cartridges in pocket, 5 shirt studs, 1 small pocket knife, 1 tobacco pipe, 1 comb, 1 block matches, 1 small piece tobacco. There is also a portion of a letter from Messrs. Herford and Zabriskie, attorneys at law, Tucson, to the deceased John Ringo. a hoodoo warrior cowboy. Originally from Indiana, born 1850, the young John Peters Ringo lived for a short time in Missouri before his family packed up and headed for California. While crossing through Wyoming, his father accidentally shot himself with his own shotgun and was buried along the trail. After a stay in San Jose, California, John left his mother, brother, and sisters in 1870 and gravitated east to Texas, where he ultimately made quite a name for himself in the Hoodoo War, an ethnic cattle feud in the Mason section. Indicted for one killing and reportedly involved in several others, he came out of Texas in the late 1870s with a reputation as a notorious and dangerous man. Ringo landed in Arizona in 1879 and described himself as a speculator in the 1882 Cochise County Great Register. After shooting a fellow drinker over his choice of liquor, his only known shooting in Arizona, Ringo took up residence in San Simon, but also stayed in Galeyville, where he held up a poker game, resulting in the third formal charge against him. He missed the Fremont street fight with the Earps and Doc Holliday, but tried to make up for it 2 months later in a failed showdown on Allen Street. At the time of his death, Ringo was one of the most well-known men in the territory and considered by the press to be the leader of the cowboys. While some who knew him could not believe he would take his own life, many others claimed Ringo frequently threatened suicide. The Ringo Mysteries Examined. In his book, Johnny Ringo, author and researcher Steve Gatto examines the so-called mysteries surrounding the King of the Cowboys' demise. Here they are with Gatto's conclusions. Mystery number one. Ringo had torn up his undershirt and wrapped pieces of it around his feet, the theory being that Ringo's bay horse had wandered off and he started off on foot to search for him. His boots began hurting him, so he pulled them off and made moccasins of his undershirt. Crazed with thirst and far from help, Ringo gave up, sat down, and shot himself. The facts. According to the coroner's report, Ringo had traveled but a short distance in this foot gear, and he was found within spitting distance of water, 200 feet, and not more than 700 feet from Smith's house. Also, the inmates of Smith's house heard a shot about 3 o'clock Thursday evening, and it is believed this is the lone shot that ended Ringo's life. The lone shot also argues against a gun battle, as described by Wyatt Earp, wherein he claims after a protracted exchange of gunfire, Earp got Ringo with a lucky shot at 75 yards. Also unlikely, given the trajectory of the death wound, which was upward at a 45-degree angle between the right eye and ear. Mystery number two. Found on Ringo's body were 2 cartridge belts, but the belt for revolver cartridges was buckled on upside down. The conspiracy theorists believe that Ringo's killer or killers put the belt on upside down to humiliate him or make a point. The facts. Ringo was on an extended drunk and possibly put his belt on incorrectly. And who's to say he didn't do it on purpose? Mystery number three. Small parts of the forehead and scalp were gone, including some hair, which the coroner's report said appeared as if someone had cut it with a knife. The facts. Even if someone had taken hair as a sort of trophy, it doesn't mean Ringo was murdered. It's possible John Yost, the man who initially found Ringo, took the hair as a souvenir. Mystery number four. There were no powder burns on Ringo's temple, suggesting that he was shot at a distance. The facts. The coroner's jury made no mention of the absence or presence of powder burns. Plus, Ringo's body had been lying in the hot sun and was decomposing rapidly and had turned black, The men were more concerned with burying the body. It probably did not occur to them that more than a century later, people would be debating the particulars of their descriptions. In conclusion, I showed Yost where the bullet had entered the tree on the left side. Blood and brains were oozing from the wound and matted his hair. There was an empty shell in the six-shooter, and the hammer was on that. I called it a suicide 52 years ago. I am still calling it a suicide. I guess I'm the last of the coroner's jury. Robert Bowler, 1934. Evolution of a legend. How did a self-described speculator and hard drinker with a modest record of kills or gunfights become one of the most famous names in the annals of Old West gunfighters? A trail of hyperbole gives us a clue. Quote, during the past few years, 32 men dared to doubt his honor. They now fill 32 graves. Although he had many competitors in his line, he had no true rivals, and Curly Bill and Billy the Kid will not bear comparison with him. Grant County Herald, July 22, 1882. Quote, Ringo was a mysterious man. He had a college education, but was reserved and morose. He drank heavily as if to drown his troubles. He was a perfect gentleman when sober, but inclined to be quarrelsome when drinking. He was a good shot and afraid of nothing, and had great authority with the rustling element. Billy Breckenridge, Hilderado, 1928. Quote, John Ringo stalks through the stories of old tombstone days like a Hamlet among outlaws, an introspective, tragic figure, darkly handsome, splendidly brave, a man born for better things, who, having thrown his life recklessly away, drowned his memories in cards and drink, and drifted without definite purpose or destination. Walter Noble Burns, Tombstone, 1927. Quote, John Ringo was a man with whom everyone in that part of Arizona must reckon, the fastest gunfighter and the deadliest, a man who courted trouble with the thoughtless courage of a bulldog. Eugene Cunningham, Trigonometry, 1941. Quote, John Ringo's image was created for him by inaccuracies of innumerable writers, and I believe that he remains a Western figure largely because of the mellifluous tonal quality of his name. Jack Burroughs in John Ringo, The Gunfighter Who Never Was, 1987. Aftermath, odds and ends. Ringo's missing horse was found 11 days later, about 2 miles from the death site. His saddle was still upon him, the epitaph reported, with Ringo's coat upon the back of it. In one of the side pockets were three photographs and a card bearing the name of Mrs. Jackson, Ringo's sister. In the 1920s, Wyatt Earp began telling a series of writers, including Forrestine Hooker, Frank Lockwood, and Frederick Beckholt, that he had waylaid and killed John Ringo as Earp and his vendetta posse were on their way out of Arizona in March 1882. Earp even drew a diagram of the fight. The problem with this claim is that Ringo died in July, almost 4 months after Wyatt had fled the state as a fugitive. This hasn't stopped some Earp buffs from fantasizing that both Wyatt and Doc Holliday snuck back from Colorado, where they were known to have been in July 1882, and assassinated the cowboy leader. Even this strains credulity when one considers that Holliday, at least, was in court in Pueblo, Colorado, 2 days before Ringo's death. Buckskin Frank Leslie reputedly was the first to take credit for the death of Ringo. While in Yuma prison for the murder of his wife, Leslie allegedly confessed to a guard that he killed Ringo. Few believe him. Another name attached to Ringo's demise has been Johnny Behind the Deuce, Michael O'Rourke, who supposedly ambushed Ringo near the latter's camp in the Chicuras. Why? O'Rourke got scared up, said Fred Dodge, a Tombstone resident at the time, who shared his story with author Stuart Lake. This version has even less adherence. Was It Suicide or Doc? By Gary Roberts, with Jeff Morey, Casey Tieferteller, and John Bosenecker. Doc Holliday did not kill John Ringo, nor did Wyatt Earp kill him. Most of the important evidence has already been presented by others here. After Colorado Governor Frederick W. Pitkin refused to honor Arizona's extradition request for the return of Holliday, Doc was ordered released on a writ of habeas corpus. Before he was processed, however, an arrest warrant for larceny was issued at Pueblo. On the morning of May 31, 1882, Deputy Sheriff Linton, Bat Masterson, and Bob Paul escorted Doc to Pueblo, where that afternoon he was charged with having swindled a man out of $400. Doc waived examination, posted bond of $300, and was bound over to the July term of court. Holliday remained in Pueblo for a while, and on June 16, 1882, he checked into the St. James Hotel in Gunnison. He was interviewed by the Gunnison paper, and it appeared in print on June 18, 1882. His reunion with Wyatt and Warren Earp continued through the end of June. On July 8, he was reported to have arrived in Salida, Colorado, with two other gamblers, Sam Osgood and Texas George Robinson. The paper reported that they would remain in Salida for several days. The visit was cut short by his court affairs in Pueblo. On June 11th, the grand jury indicted Doc for larceny and advised the sheriff that he could admit Doc to bail in the amount of $500. Clearly, the process had been worked out in advance because the district attorney and the said defendant in his own proper person, as well as by his counsel, W.G. Hollins, Esquire, also came. Doc pled not guilty, posted bail, and was released. On July 18th, the case was continued, and the same day, the Leadville Daily Herald reported that Doc was visiting in Leadville. Remember, Ringo died on July 13th. It is worth noting that Chuck Hornung, in his Wyatt Earp's cowboy campaign, The Bloody Restoration of Law and Order Along the Mexican Border, 1882, acknowledges that Steve Gatto and I made a strong case that Doc was in Pueblo based on the court records. He suggests that Doc's appearance and the document's language could have been a subterfuge in a covert operation hatched in Gunnison by the Earps. Here is a brief item from the Gunnison News Democrat, July 15, 1882, that I believe scuttles the Wyatt Earp killed John Ringo story as well. Misters Wyatt and Warren Earp expect to leave for San Francisco in a day or two. As far as I know, this article has not been published since it appeared in the Gunnison paper, and it is consistent with the movement of the Earps. I have not confirmed when exactly they left Gunnison, but when they left, they headed for San Francisco, where Wyatt and Josephine reunited. Early in 1883, they returned to Colorado. I cannot believe that either Wyatt or Doc had any desire to undertake such a perilous mission. Doc's movements were followed closely, and Wyatt stayed in Gunnison until after Doc's extradition effort was dropped. A clarification or two. After splitting up with Wyatt in Albuquerque, Doc and Dan Tipton proceeded to Colorado. The others in the posse followed shortly. The destination was Trinidad, where Bat Masterson had just been elected city marshal. Doc appreciated the rest. The other Vendetta riders arrived surreptitiously in El Morro just south of Trinidad. Wyatt seemed comfortable there and enjoyed the company of Bat Masterson for a few days. Wyatt, Warren, and Tipton left for Gunnison on May 5th, actually bound first for Pueblo for a scheduled boxing match in South Pueblo that never happened because the contestants could not agree on a referee. The Earp stayed in Pueblo a day or two afterward, said their goodbyes to Bat, and left for Gunnison. According to the Pueblo papers, the other associates of the Earps went south at that point. Doc lingered at Trinidad longer, clearly feeling safe and secure. On May 8th, back in Tombstone, Judge Stillwell closed the case on his altercation with Milt Joyce. 2 days later, Doc moved on to Pueblo and the gambling opportunities in South Pueblo. On March 14th, he left Pueblo with Texas George Robinson and Sam Osgood, two gambling buddies, bound for Denver and the horse races. Masterson was on the same train. At the fairgrounds in Denver, Doc, his friends, and Bat Masterson spent the day. Among those they spoke with were David J. Cook, head of the Rocky Mountain Detective Agency, and Denver Police Chief James Lomery. That night, on Doc's way to a meeting with Colorado mining man John Vimont, who had been known in Tombstone, he was accosted and arrested by Perry Mallon. He returned to Pueblo after the governor refused to extradite him in company with Deputy Sheriff Linton from Pueblo, Bat Masterson, and Bob Paul. On May 31st, Doc appeared in court on larceny charges and was released on bond. On June 4th, Wyatt made his first public statement about the situation in Arizona. Doc soon joined the Earps in Gunnison, where he was interviewed yet again and spent the balance of June with his former comrades. About July 1st, he and his gambling friends, Robinson and Osgood, showed up in Salida, on the railroad between Gunnison and Pueblo, where Doc was due to appear in court on July 11th. They stayed there a few days before proceeding to Pueblo and his court date. Judd Riley, an officer of the law in Gunnison, said later that the Earp party caused no trouble in Gunnison that summer, except for a couple of episodes when Doc had too much to drink. The others quickly took Doc under control on those occasions. Incidentally, for those interested in such matters, Riley said that Earp wore two pistols high under his shoulders. The stop at Salida explains why Doc was there and helps establish Doc's movements. Gary Roberts, author of Doc Holliday, Life and Legend. Rain-Soaked Standoff, January 17, 1882. The inevitable rematch between the Cowboys and the Earp gang almost becomes reality, with Doc Holliday and John Ringo facing off on Allen Street in front of the Occidental Saloon. The Earps and their supporters are lined up on the north side of Fremont Street, with the Cowboys on the south side. Before a fight can happen, police officer Jim Flynn grabs Ringo from behind and arrests him and Doc. Taken to city court, Ringo and Doc are fined $30 each for carrying concealed weapons. Wyatt Earp, who was watching in the crowd, is also arrested on a weapons charge, but that is dropped because he is a U.S. deputy marshal. Who did it? Three experts share their perspective. Frankly, I have never been fully convinced that Ringo committed suicide. The upside-down belt is weird, and there is absolutely no mention of any holster. Finally, that citizen's report on Ringo, on his demise, claims that there was a hat on Ringo's head when the body was found. If Ringo offed himself, it is hard to imagine how he managed to keep his hat on. To me, Johnny Ringo's death remains an unsolved homicide. Maybe it was a suicide. Maybe it wasn't. Unless and until more reliable information is obtained, the exact fate of Johnny Ringo remains a mystery because we simply don't have enough reliable information to settle the matter once and for all. Jeff Morey. There is a slim possibility that someone else killed Ringo, but it is extremely unlikely that it was Wyatt Earp, since he was in Colorado, and even the Buntline special could not shoot that far. I have a really fascinating old pulp Western magazine from the 1930s, with a first-person witness quoted telling how he watched Nashville Frank Leslie kill Ringo. My grandfather had saved the magazine, and 30 years after his death, it was like a gift from the past. The article was by Ed Earl Repp, who wrote many TV shows. The most likely COD, cause of death, remains suicide. Casey Tieferteller. The Pueblo court shows that Doc appeared in propria persona, meaning he was there in person. So it was physically impossible for him to be in Arizona. The Boyer fans and kooks used to claim that Doc was not there and his lawyer appeared for him. But the language in propria persona eliminates that totally. John Bossenecker. Hello, this is Michael, reading from the archives of True West Magazine, December 1957 edition. The Real Calamity Jane. In a leather-bound album, now in possession of Mrs. Don C. Foote of Billings, Montana, a legendary character of the Old West reveals some startling facts about herself. By Catherine Wright. Of all the famous women of the Old West, none have been cloaked with more contradictory legends than the notorious Calamity Jane. In the half century since her death on August 2, 1903, Calamity has been endowed with the vocabulary of a mule skinner, the liquor capacity of a John Barleyhorn, the morals of a Madame Du Barry and Pompadour, and the various attributes and skills of Florence Nightingale, Annie Oakley, Poker Alice, Jim Bridger, and Buffalo Bill. The real woman was astounding enough without the legends. Calamity was born Martha Jane Canary on May 1, 1852 in Princeton, Missouri, rode a spectacular trail that, in the last half of the 1800s, took her into the West's army forts, gold camps, Indian lodges, and boom towns. She scorned the frills of women in saloons she frequented, preferring the buckskin garb of the plain scout. To the public and her casual companions of drinking and gambling houses in towns along stagecoach roads, riverbanks, and immigrant trails, the blue-eyed redhead was a tobacco-chewing, cigar-smoking, hard-drinking product of the frontier. Hard as nails, and independent as any man. But Calamity left a written record of her life, indicating that beneath her fringed leather shirt beat as feminine a heart as any under a fancy bodice. This record, a series of letters written on cardboard pages of a leather-bound picture album, is owned by Mr. and Mrs. Don C. Foote of Billings, Montana, and is displayed in their museum, Wonderland. Its yellowed pages, filled with a generally unpunctuated scrawl, bring to light Calamity's evidence of her marriage to James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, and their turbulent love, the divorce and final resumption of that love, justifying the illicit romance with these words, "I was glad to have him again, even if he was married and she so far away. I always excused our sin by knowing he was mine long before he was hers." The diary and a sheaf of other letters and documents, all full of heartbreak, spine-tingling adventures in Indian country, lonely nights by campfires, nights with Wild Bill and a second husband, Charlie Burke, poverty, sickness, and hatred were accepted by the United States government as Calamity's property and as satisfactory proof of the identity and age of Mrs. Jean Hickok McCormick of Billings. Mrs. McCormick, who left the diary and other mementos to Wonderland Museum upon her death in Billings, February 21, 1951, applied for old age assistance in 1941. After a thorough study and investigation, she was found eligible for aid and on September 6, 1941, was listed in the files of the U.S. Department of Public Welfare as the daughter of Martha Jane, Calamity Jane, Cannery, and James Butler, Wild Bill, Hickok, born September 25, 1873, at Benson's Landing. This was an early day settlement near the present town of Livingston, Montana. First entry in the diary was made September 25, 1877, in Deadwood, Dakota Territory, and is headed, "To Jim O'Neill, please give this album to my daughter, Janie Hickok, after my death. Jane Hickok." Jim O'Neill was Captain James O'Neill, a sea captain who maintained a home in Richmond, Virginia. Calamity had given her daughter to O'Neill for adoption in 1874. In Deadwood, September 1880, Calamity wrote in her diary, "Janie, a letter from your daddy, Jim, came today, and another picture of you. Your picture brought back all the years I lived with your father and recalled how jealous I was of him. I feel like writing about him tonight, so I will tell you some things you should know. I met James Butler Hickok, Wild Bill, in 1870 near Abilene. I heard a bunch of outlaws planning to kill him. I couldn't get to where my horse was, so I crawled on my hands and knees through the brush, past the outlaws for over a mile, and reached the old shack where Bill was staying that night. I told him, and he hid me back of the door while he shot it out with them. They hit him, cutting open the top of his head. Then they heard him fall and lit matches to see if he was dead. Bill killed them all. I'll never forget what he looked like with blood running down his face while he used two guns. He never aimed, and I guess he was never known to miss anyone he shot at. I mean, those he wanted to kill. He only shot in self-defense. Then he was quite sick. I nursed him several days. And then while on the trip to Abilene, we met Reverend Sipes, and Reverend Warren and we were married. There will be lots of folks doubt that we were ever married, but I will leave you plenty of proof that we were. You were not a woods colt, Janie. Don't let any of those pus-gutted blatherskites get by with that lie." Warning her daughter against jealousy, Calamity continued, "It, jealousy, kills love and all the nice things of life. It drove your father from me. When I lost him, I lost everything I ever loved except you. I gave him a divorce so he could marry Agnes Lake. I was trying to make amends for the jealous times and my spells of meanness. If she had loved him, she would have come out here with him. But she didn't, and I was glad to have him again, even if he was married and she was so far away. I always excused our sin by knowing he was mine long before he was hers." Hickok, who was shot in the back of the head in a Deadwood saloon on August 2, 1876, married Mrs. Agnes Lake in Cheyenne, Wyoming, March 5, 1876. He left shortly afterward for the Black Hills. Agnes never saw him again. According to Hickok's early biographers, she moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, and was living there in 1880. Meanwhile, the West's foremost woman scout was in Deadwood, nursing a broken heart and wounded vanity. chronic ailments that had plagued her since her marriage to Bill 6 years before. Womanlike, she decided to snub him should their paths cross again. She quickly discovered that such a course was impossible for her to follow. We met one day, and we both found we still loved each other better than ever. I forgot everything when I was near him. No one else ever knew. If anyone hinted such to me, I hauled off and knocked them down. He denied it also. We both lived a life of lies. He was meant for me, not Agnes Lake, or he would have stayed with her instead of coming back to me. Of her second marriage, Calamity wrote on September 25, 1891, "I did a crazy thing some time ago. I married Charlie Burke. He got me in a weak moment, and we were married. What became of Charlie? There is no later reference to him, except a brief mention in a letter Calamity wrote to Captain O'Neill, June 20, 1898, from Stringtown, now Bridger, Montana. I am so blue and disgusted with life. I have Belle Starr's little girl with me. Her father was Bill's cousin. She worries me to death. Burke is so mean to her. I have gotten so I hate him." A respite from Burke and Belle Starr's little girl came in August 1893 when Calamity joined Colonel William F. Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show and toured eastern states and England. Some of Cody's biographers relate that Calamity's career as a member of the troupe was short-lived because of her excessive drinking. Of that tour, Calamity wrote bitterly a few years later, "4 years have slipped by, and I am back in Deadwood. I am tired and feel so old. I am nursing again. I can always fall back on that. I got so lonely for our old West and so disgusted with gadding all over the world. Lord, how I hate England with its snobs, its good-for-nothing women with their put-on airs. They forget that they were thrashed by a handful of Americans not so long ago. I felt like shouting it from the treetops. I never saw so many parasites as there are in England, especially the women with their blokes, just because they have handed down one generation to the next some bed-buggy estate. They get the idea they are aristocrats, or in plain words, just plain paupers." Obviously, the trip was an unhappy experience for rough-and-ready Calamity Jane. It must also have been an edifying experience for the English women with whom she came in contact. Of Billings, Montana, where she is remembered by many old-timers, Calamity was equally vituperative. "Billings," she wrote, "is some lively town. It supports about 1,500 toughs. These are hectic days, like hell let out for noon. These human parasites prosper, both men and women. The respectable citizens of the town are powerless. They can't even control the elections. The police figure they would risk complete annihilation by attempting raids on the dens running at top steam. Block after block is appropriated, composed entirely of saloons and sporting houses. In the center of this whirlpool of saloons and dives may be seen the house of Madame Feely, the hub from which the lesser spokes in the wheel radiate. Any old-timer in the Yellowstone Valley can tell about Feely's house. It is a large building with brilliantly illuminated windows. A force of professional bouncers are maintained by the establishment to preserve a degree of peace. Madame Feely reigns supreme. She is an anomaly, a mighty attractive woman, neither ruthless nor unscrupulous. Located near the Yellowstone River is an inferior spoke in the wheel. In its basement are evil, dirty-smelling, poorly lighted dens, vile and dangerous where a trap door opens directly into the river to accommodate those who just can't take it. More often, they are robbed and dumped into the river because the gang thinks they're spies or stool pigeons. I am telling you this because I want you to know the sort of world we have here. So Calamity found Billings in 1893. How Billings found Calamity 9 years later was chronicled in the Billings Gazette, November 21st, 1902. The account reads, "Calamity Jane is in trouble and in jail again. For some times past, she has been acting more than unusually unruly and has committed several overt breaches of the peace. Among her more recent escapades was one of yesterday, and which would have resulted seriously but for the timely interference of a bystander. Without any apparent reason, save that suggested by a mind more or less overstimulated by her favorite tipple, Jane armed herself with a hatchet and invaded Yeegan Brothers' store and attempted to put an end to one of the young ladies employed in the dry goods department. She advanced toward her with hatchet uplifted and said she was going to chop her to pieces, then and there. It may have been only one of Jane's practical jokes, but the victim, having little sense of humor, screamed for help. One of the male clerks disarmed the belligerent Calamity and assisted her from the battlefield. No complaint was made, and she retired in order. This morning, Calamity visited another store on the south side and again threw down the gauge. She was promptly arrested and would be tried this afternoon should she be sober enough to face the bar of justice. It is deemed likely that she will receive a sentence long enough to give her time to sober up." Besides her love for liquor and fights, Calamity also had a domestic streak, as shown in a diary entry in which she tells of purchasing land west of Billings. She wrote, "I have a cabin of logs on it. There is a shack not very far away from my hut and a bunch of outlaws living there. I cook lots of things for them, and they pay me well for everything. I baked 2 dozen loaves of bread this week, 8 cakes, 15 mince pies. I'm going to write down my recipes for you. Maybe someday you might like to know if I could cook or not. I am proud of my cooking, especially of my fish, dishes, cakes, and pies." The outlaws apparently didn't pay Calamity enough, for the land went to taxes a few years later. Some rotting logs and a crumbling stone fireplace chimney remain as mute evidence of her residence there. Whether Calamity realized her land was gone is a question. In June 1903, back in Deadwood, ill and nearly blind, Calamity scrawled, "I am sick and haven't long to live. I am taking many secrets with me, Janie, what I am and what I might have been. I am not as black as I've been painted. I want you to believe that. If you ever come out here, fix up my old home and be sure to find General Allen of Billings. He was a good friend." Knowing her time was short, Calamity sent for Captain O'Neill and in his presence laboriously wrote a confession which fills the last pages of the album. "I, Jane Hickok Burke, better known as Calamity Jane, of my own free will and being of sound mind, do this day, June 3rd, 1903, make this my confession. I have lied about my past life. To help clear up my daughter's birthright and my sister's daughter's birth, I am making this confession to James O'Neill to make public or to keep to himself. I was born in Missouri. I had several sisters, but only one is to be mentioned in this. People got snoopy, so I told them lies to hear their tongues wag. The women are all snakes, and none of them I can call friends. All letters and information given prior to this are lies, except the diary I have kept for Janie since 1877. The only lie in that is where I said Belle Starr was no kin of mine. She was my sister, raised by Ben Waddell and his wife. They were killed in the 80s in Oklahoma. They never knew our relation. After their death, Belle came to me under the name of Starr. She married William Hickok, cousin to my daughter's father, James Butler Hickok. I lied about having a daughter born to me in 1887. I nursed my sister Belle at that time. She gave birth to a girl whom she named Jessie Elizabeth. Then Jack Oakes came from Fort Pierre. Hickok believed the worst of his wife. He was ashamed of her doings and refused to live with her. She lived with Jack Oakes, and to them was born a son, Charlie Oakes. Jessie Elizabeth was born October 28, 1887, near Benson's Landing, where Janie was born September 25, 1873. Belle posed as my daughter and Jessie Elizabeth as my granddaughter. They were neither, for Belle was older than I am. Charlie's father murdered a man in Fort Pierre. I have been called the common law wife of King, Sonyers Wilson, and Dorset. I was legally married to Hickok and Burke. I dare anyone to deny these facts. Signed, Jane Hickok Burke. Those who signed as witnesses were James O'Neill, R.R. Ryan, and N.K. Sipes. Calamity's claim of marriage to Hickok has been generally denied and ridiculed in after years, and Calamity herself kept it hidden during her lifetime. Death on August 2, 1903, brought her openly to a permanent association and place with Wild Bill. Their graves lie side by side in Deadwood's Mount Moriah Cemetery. Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from True West Magazine's archives. October 1979 edition. Attacked by a rabid horse, a wild race of 2 miles, armed only with a buggy whip. By Lois Stevens. In a civilized area such as the Thurman, Iowa community was in 1907, few people carried a gun, and certainly no one would expect to need one on a short trip to visit friends during the holiday season. My aunt, Lucretia Mustard, lived near Thurman on that fateful first day after Christmas in 1907. Lucretia had married Horace Williams in 1883 and had continued to manage the farm with the aid of her 2 sons after her husband's death. One of Aunt Crete's horses had been sick for several days, unable to determine the reason, but doing all she or the boys knew to aid him, they fastened him securely in the barn and left for the day. Before they returned, the horse went on a rampage and kicked the barn to pieces. "All to smithereens," my mother said, and escaped to the open road. Here, Mr. and Mrs. M.A. Stevenson encountered him on their way home to Thurman after a day spent with their friends, the S.L. Kelloggs. Their light driving team pulled a single buggy, fortunately with the top up. Mr. Stevenson first noticed the horse ambling a few yards ahead of them, crowding the hedge at the side of the road. They both noticed that he would careen into protruding branches, stop, veer to one side until he had cleared the obstruction, then again crowd into the hedge. This seemed a bit unusual, but Mr. Stevenson concluded the horse must be blind and attributed his staggering gait and collisions with the low branches to natural causes. Stevenson said the following day that he should have recognized that the horse's erratic behavior held a greater portent. When the couple attempted to pass and the buggy was directly opposite the animal, he suddenly wheeled about, sprang into the middle of the road ahead of the team, then turned and came toward them in a savage attack, striking and biting Stevenson's left-hand horse. The unlooked-for attack so frightened the two horses that an upset of the buggy was narrowly averted. Stevenson kept the team in hand, however, and believing the horse could be driven away, reached out with his whip when he got the team on the road again, and cut the beast a few blows in the head. The animal paid not the slightest attention to the blows with the whip, but continued to threaten and snap at the rear horse. Realizing now that he had had a rabid horse to deal with, and that his own and his wife's safety were in imminent peril, Stevenson turned his team around and, giving them free rein, started back over the same road at top speed. This effort to shake off the mad attack, however, proved unavailing. Sometimes the horse would gain the flank of the now frantic team, biting first one and then the other, flecking their sides with bloody froth that poured from his mouth. Then he would drop behind to snap viciously at the buggy top, which did give some protection to the Stevensons, before spurting ahead to renew his attack on the team. The road was empty of travelers or help of any kind. Stevenson continued to lash the beast over the head with his whip until, piece by piece, it broke away. By this time, the near horse's sides were lacerated and bloodied. The right ear of the off horse had been turned to shreds. When the last stub of the whip flew out of his hands, Stevenson concluded that their only hope was to crowd the crazed animal off the road and escape before he could get his bearings. Remembering a ditch crossing at the road near the McFarland place, Stevenson turned his now almost exhausted team into the lane leading to the bridge. The ditch had a sheer drop of some 5 or 6 feet, and Stevenson guided his team as close to the bridge railing as he dared. The half-blind, enraged animal, still clinging to the flank of the near horse, failed to see the danger and was literally scraped off of the bridge abutment. He fell over end into the ditch. Stevenson slowed his team after a few hundred yards and looked back for some sign of pursuit. Seeing no sign of the horse, he drove to the nearest farmhouse to alert them of the danger. Other neighbors were summoned, and a group of men soon gathered at the scene, armed and prepared to dispatch the horse quickly if it were still alive. This proved unnecessary, as the horse died shortly after the men reached the bridge. The Stevensons' horses, of course, had to be shot, as there was no known preventative for rabies. They were doomed. The story was repeated many times in our family, but I never knew what happened in terms of my Aunt Creek's liability in the matter, whether she paid for the Stevensons' horses or did not. However, since she lived in a small rural community, a widow with two young boys to raise, it is possible that these factors were taken into consideration, or that the incident was accepted as unavoidable, an act of God. Recounting the experience later, Mr. Stevenson said that none of the several battles of the Civil War that he went through scared him half as bad as this affair with a mad horse, and that he hoped he would never again have the occasion to wish so hard for a gun. He could have shot the horse time and time again, he said, and so ended the terrifying experience, had he only happened to have carried one with him.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.